Moderator of the next panel is Dr. Harold Leaf, and I have the privilege of introducing him to you, although I think most of you know him quite well. I noticed that Adrian Mack and Roger Scotford started their introduction by a personal story, and I have a nice personal story to say about Dr. Leaf, but I'm leading it to the end of my introduction. So first the official part, and then the private part. Dr. Leaf, as I already mentioned, is a member of the Professional Advisory Board. You know that, but maybe not all of you know that he was the founding member of the foundation and one of the first members of the Professional Board with us since the very beginning in March 1992, or maybe even before that. Dr. Leaf graduated from the New York School of Medicine in 1942, and he completed his residency in psychiatry at Long Island Medical College. It was during the war, so shortly after that he had to go to Europe to fight in World War II. He won 4 Battle Stars and Invasion Arrowhead, and after the war he decided to specialize in psychoanalysis. He completed his psychoanalytic training at Columbia University in 1950. After that, he joined the Department of Psychiatry at Tulane University, and throughout his career, he held several academic positions at various universities. His current title is Professor Emeritus at University of Pennsylvania and Clinical Professor of Psychiatry at Jefferson Medical College. Now, the word emeritus sort of indicate that he may be retired. At least to me, when I hear emeritus, I think that that's retired. So I asked yesterday, Dr. Leaf, when did you retire? And he said, me? No, I didn't retire. I worked. Okay, so he didn't retire. List of accomplishments of Dr. Leaf is long and diverse, and his professional life is rich and rewarding. And I would probably spend the whole afternoon just going through all his accomplishments. So let me just give you a statistics. Throughout his professional career, he held membership in 21 national and 6 regional professional societies. He received 19 awards or honorary memberships, and has written over 260 professional articles. His latest award is gold medal from World Association of Sexology, which he received in 1999. He is listed in Who is Who in America and Who is Who in the World. His views about his role in life are quoted in Who is Who in the World, and these are Dr. Leaf's words. I quote, "The conflict between individual gratification and the needs of society, between competition and cooperation, appears to me to be the most fundamental issue confronting mankind. My goal in life has been to steer a course that fosters service to others and to society without undue sacrifice of individual aspirations." End of quote. Now, on the lighter note, let me share my personal experience. It was back in 1993 in Montreal. Dr. Leaf was invited to give a first public lecture at McGill University to a large audience, and then the next day he was supposed to give a seminar, professional seminar, one day long to medical professionals. The first event, that means the McGill University lecture, was held in a huge auditorium, and there were, you know, hundreds and hundreds of students. There was also a group of foster accused parents, I was one of them, and two retractors. And Gail, actually, one of the retractors who spoke this morning, wrote about this experience in her book. What happened was that there was also a group of women who came there to disrupt the speech, and they were shouting and yelling and whistling, And what happened, Dr. Leaf was prevented from delivering his speech. I believe this was a very traumatic experience for him, but I don't think he repressed memories. Well, did you? I don't think so.
Continuous memories.
Continuous memories. Well, what was sort of what was ironic about this event, that these protesters really achieved something they didn't plan to achieve. This event was filmed and it was shown on Canadian television, national television from coast to coast. So back in 1993, when this problem of recovered memories and false memory syndrome was not yet recognized, or not as widely recognized as now, the Canadians from coast to coast heard the word false memories and false memory syndrome for the first time, thanks to Dr. Leaf, and actually thanks to the protesters. So, this is my personal story, and I would like to conclude my brief introduction by thanking Dr. Leaf for his work for the foundation, for his work for the unfortunate people who were influenced or affected by this recovered memory fad.
Well, early had some trouble. I can just see myself falling off this platform. One of the nice byproducts of that unfortunate experience in Montreal was meeting Paula and becoming a friend of hers since 1993. So thank you very much for that lovely introduction, Paula. I wonder whether it would be helpful for all of us to stand up and stretch for a couple of minutes.
Not on this stage,
no. Please.
I get come back to the studio. Did you hear Ralph?
No, I didn't get here until
okay.
Sorry, I missed it.
Better. Long enough stretch.
Yes.
The legal aspects.
Yeah, he's going to talk again tomorrow, I think.
Very good.
You know, we've had such a wonderful, rich day of exchanging ideas that one always comes to a new part of the program with some trepidation. I'm reminded of a preacher I knew in Princeton, and one Sunday morning after his sermon was over, this lady approached him and said, "You know, you give such wonderful sermons. Each sermon is better than the next." That's about well, I hope we won't disappoint you. You know, there's a lot of feeling against psychiatry and against psychotherapy, and in view of the experiences of the families in this group, most of it is justified. But there is good psychotherapy and bad psychotherapy, and we'll talk more about that as we go along. But I am reminded, however, of a study I once did on silence in psychotherapy. And part of what I discovered was this anecdote. A well-known psychoanalyst had patients on the hour. So this 4 o'clock patient came in and took his place on the couch as usual. He got up at the end of his hour. The next patient came in at 5 and took his place on the couch. At 6 o'clock, or roughly 10 minutes of 6, when he got up after his 50-minute session, He looked around, took another look at his analyst, and discovered the analyst was dead. Now, the autopsy revealed that the analyst had died at 4 o'clock. But if you think about it, silence would have been a lot better than the kind of nonsense that our accusers went through. If you had to choose between them, silence would have been a lot better. Now, the American Psychiatric Association has been talked about here as a kind of horrible, oppressive monolith. But it's not all that bad. This past year, Janet Fedkevitz and I had a chapter published in the annual Annals of Psychiatry dealing with the impact of these accusations of incest on fathers. And so it's a little crack in this monolith, and the crack has to be widened. We've got a lot to do to persuade the mental health associations, and particularly the American Psychiatric Association, to take a firm stand endorsing the views that we all in this room share. Now, when we look at the groups of families that we want to talk about today, it seems to me there are three groups. I think you probably agree with this. There's an alienated group where the accusers, of course, mostly women, have had no contact or at best some minimal contact with the families. That's one group of families. A second group, and probably the largest, well, we need a lot of work on this, are the returnees, those who come back but have not retracted the accusations. And some of them avoid talking about it, and others can discuss it to a certain extent. And despite the discussions, despite the dialogue within the family, that accuser still holds on to her belief system. Now, we need to study these families much more thoroughly. Janet and I have studied the retractors, but we haven't studied the returnees. And I would ask those families where there are returnees, if they wouldn't want to get in touch with me, I would love to hear from you, because this is a group that I feel I want to personally pursue to try to enlarge our understanding of the family issues and the family dynamics in these returnee groups. And the third group of families, of course, are the retractors. And there again, we have subgroups. It's different if you're dealing with an early retractor, let's say in the first 6 months, and there's a middle group who've been back with the family for 6 to 24 months, and then there are those who've been there for more than 2 years. So there are, the time element is significant in what happens in the family. Now, it also makes a difference whether the retractor or even the returnee is living with the family or living apart. That's another dimension. Here I'm just raising issues that I hope the panel and the audience will discuss as we go along. I'm not giving any answers here. Now, what about the accusations, which Janet and I studied with the retractors and with the sample of fathers that we wrote about in that chapter in the Annual Review of Psychiatry? How much difference does the content of the accusations make in what happens in the family? What about the form in which the accusations were delivered? Were they done personally, by letter, phone, or through a third party? Does that make a difference in what happens in the family? What about the social context? Is this maintained as a private matter, or is it a public one? What happens if the accusations are shared with family, with friends, or even in the community? I'm reminded of one of the fathers we talked to. I asked him this question about the context, the public or private. He says, well, I didn't have a choice because my accuser, who was a Christian counselor, got up in my church one Sunday morning and told the entire congregation about the accusations. So this was a, that was his therapist, Christian counselor therapist. So you can imagine how devastating this was. Now what about contacts with a therapist? Who does the initiation? Is it an adversarial, as it most often is, or is there some semblance of a therapeutic relationship between the family and the therapist? Another big issue are the relations between the spouses. What is the relationship between the accused person and the non-accused parent? What are the differences of both are accused? And we know that happens in SRA accusations where you have multiple perpetrators, and then more often than not, both parents are accused. What happens to the relationships in those various situations? What about siblings who have obviously often divided loyalties? Do they side with the accusing woman, or do they side with the parents? And what happens to their lives, and what happens to the family when the sibling believes the accuser or sides with the family? Makes a big difference. Now what about, and we've had some talk about this today, but what about the issues of birthdays and anniversaries? That's especially an acute issue in alienated families where there is absolutely no contact between family, parents, and the accusing person. The issue of grandchildren. This is a very painful issue, probably to many in this room. Is there alienation with grandchildren, or what are the special circumstances when parents are allowed, as it were, permitted to have some contact with the grandchildren? What are they told, if anything? How do they live with a family secret, quote unquote? What about another issue that's been raised today? What about the mental and social well-being of the returnee or the retractor? How does the family deal with that very large issue, especially in view of the enormous distrust generated by the mental health professions? How does one get adequate therapy, if one gets any at all, in the face of this huge distrust? How does the family deal with issues of shame, guilt, anger, what I would call the emergency emotions of life? How does the family deal with these untoward feelings? What happens in the face of guilt? What happens when the accuser, for example, starts to expiate her guilt in some fashion or another in an attempt to reduce her sense of guilt? What about the issue of punishment or retribution? The impulse for revenge versus the more Christian forgiveness. What about the issue of boundaries or space within the family, and even between the family and the outside world? How are those negotiated? to some of the issues that I thought of, and I can assure you that I have not thought of everyone. There are so many issues in this acute, horribly emotional and divisive situation that I probably haven't thought of to address. All I know, Janet and I found that in the families we have studied, this became a defining time in the life of the parent and of the family. We found in several cases that there was a stroke or a heart attack, and I'm sure probably some of you have had friends where death has occurred without reconciliation. So it becomes for almost all a defining moment. I can think of one exception in all the people we have studied. This was a man who reported to us that he knew nothing about the accusations until his daughter retracted her accusations. So that's a very unusual situation. I know of only one case where it did not become a defining moment in that person and that family's lives. And to discuss these issues and others I haven't thought of, we have a wonderful panel. And we're going to go from my right to left. And the first person on the panel is Dr. Halperin, David Halperin, who I know have known for some years. We're both psychoanalysts, believe it or not. That sounds like a horrible thing to say in this audience. We're members of the American Academy of Psychoanalysis, which in itself was organized in as a way of dealing with the authoritarianism of the American Psychoanalytic Association. So it was a rogue group in its at its outset. Dr. Halperin.
I'd just like to share a few remarks with you, but one thing I think is always important to be aware of is that Freud himself, during the course of his work, was confronted at a very early point with accusations by his patients that their parents had been sexually abusing him. And then, in a heroic act, decided rather than simply accepting a simplistic and gothic solution, which is to say that, yes, it's all the parents' fault, then further began to explore it and indeed discovered that what we're dealing with are universal fantasies that have existed for thousands, codeterminous with human history. So that the analytic movement actually, at its beginning, both dealt with this issue and came down on the side ultimately of reality. And it's not surprising that as there has been a certain revolt against the analytic ideas, that this type of accusation has come along in the wake, perhaps, of the garbage scow. Now, what I'd like to do very briefly, really, is talk about the history that we all have watched or unfortunately experienced and place it into a somewhat broader viewpoint with the idea of finally looking at recanters and reconciliation. And for this I'd like to use the model of a former professor of mine at college, one of the great historians certainly of his generation, Crane Brinton, whose book entitled An Anatomy of Revolution is in many ways describes the type of process that we've looked at. Brinton talked about revolutions as following a fever curve. and I'd like to examine the fever curve as you have experienced it, as we have all watched it. In the first prodromal period of the revolution, there is a diffuse and widespread sense of anger, a sense of injustice, a sense of rage. People are certain that something is wrong, that the powers that be, in this case, I believe the patriarchal society is considered to be the enemy, have done something wrong, that they have not managed things as well as they could be managed, and an inchoate sense of rage forms towards these people, these maintainers of the old order. And then some members of the old order, if you will, attempt to meet with people in discussion, attempt to look at what's been happening, may even make some movement to say that, well, I guess not every parent has been perfect, and any attempt at dialogue is scorned as hypocritical, as an attempt to outmaneuver the Simon Pure and idealistic revolutionary. The revolution increases in speed, in intensity. There is no recognition that indeed any parent has ever been good. The focus is on destroying the family system as we've known it, and substituting any one of a number of utopian alternatives which will replace the nuclear family as we have known it. The assumption being that village families, communitarian families, etc., will all offer some less destructive approach towards child rearing, and that indeed the parents should of the past should be held up and marked down against the standards of some utopian future. Finally, there is the development of an ideology which, no matter how it is expressed, reduces itself to one of the ends justifies the means, that the utopian goal is so great, so justified, that the replacement is so important that, okay, so occasionally we destroy a few people because the accusation wasn't accurate, but after all, look at the goal of what we are trying to establish. And that becomes the preeminent wisdom, accepted wisdom. Having seen the prodromal stage begin, it begins to fade into the stage of the acute mania. In the acute mania, as Britain saw it, the old language is changed. King Street becomes Republic Street in downtown New York. The statue of George III is dismembered, and parts of it exist in the historical museum. Old buildings are destroyed. If you've ever had the chance to see the beautiful movie The Red Violin, Western music is accused. But the point of the matter is the past is seen as inherently evil, that no part of it is seen as justified. Everything that parents have done is now reinterpreted, placed in a framework of manipulation, hypocrisy, and control. And so whatever the parent raises in their defense is met with this rigid, hostile, very suspicious approach. The fever intensifies. In Britain's terminology, the tumbrils start to roll. The guillotine marches up and down, up and down, up and down. Finally, irrationality reigns, as Antoine Lavoisier, the founder of modern chemistry, is led to the guillotine, and someone says, but he is the greatest French scientist alive. And someone comments, well, what need does France have of scientists? And so I think that one begins to see the sense of, as someone comments in Julius Caesar, as Caesar is walking towards the Senate, he's a poet, kill him for his verses. So again, we have this great sense of irrationality reigning supreme. Finally, and hopefully this is where we are at now, there is a period of Thermidorian restoration in Britain's terms. There is a lysis, to use the old-fashioned word, of the fever. There is suddenly a recognition that we have killed off all the scientists, all the artists, all the opera people, that we're only left with the four plays written by Mao Zedong's Gang of Four. There must be more to Chinese culture than this. And so finally, slowly, one begins to see the death of the revolution. The fever curve begins to subside. People begin to say, well, maybe we shouldn't destroy that temple. After all, a famous revolutionary built it. Or maybe, well, that piece of music, you know, he was really a friend of the people. And so one begins to see slowly the tendrils of reason begin reasserting itself. The neural fibrils start to regrow into what has been a gangrenously wounded area. And there is a beginning of recognition that injustice was committed in the names of a utopian vision. Then finally, and hopefully we are at a point now of synthesis and reconciliation, in which the persecuted and the persecutors finally begin to rebuild, try and recreate the world as they knew this. Now, of course, the first approach in doing this is to focus on the future. And I would like to really emphasize this to parents who are in this dilemma, that all of you, hopefully, have long lives ahead of you, and it's important to focus on the life to come, not the life that was. Without a recognition that work together is one of the future, one will not see a change. I'm reminded of someone I met many years ago who was a Palestinian refugee, and Sadat had just visited Israel. And I said, what did you think of the future? And she talked about Haifa in 1948. I said, well, what do you think of the future? She kept talking about Haifa in 1948. I said, you know, when you have a marriage, the purpose of marriage is to close the past. That your purpose of marriage is to build a future. That unless you stop looking at what happened in 1948, you will never see the future. And I don't think she saw that then. Hopefully she has seen it now. But in any event, in terms of the individual, I think that's a very important issue. And certainly, in terms of families, that's a very important issue. Secondly, is a recognition that guerrilla warfare is not cheap on any level, emotionally, financially, socially, just in the vast amounts of time legal procedures take. And so the focus has to be whatever happened is done, what the future is, at the very least, it will not involve guerrilla warfare. And that in itself can be helpful. One always has to remember the Signal Act in American history of Grant telling Lee to keep his swords and horses at Appomattox. He will need them for the spring planting. If he could do that after a 4 or 5 year civil war, I think families have to begin to think of the future in those terms as well. Now, this is part of that. I think it's very important to recognize on the parent's part that the child, in many cases, was an unwitting victim. They did not really see what would happen here. People just wanted their land to be redistributed, perhaps to have a little more freedom of speech. They didn't expect the guillotines to roll. And if that was true historically, it's certainly in many cases true of the children. They did not really see what the net result would be when they started on this path, nor were they guided as to what the net result would be. They are, in that sense, innocent. An additional factor, of course, is that the child should be helped to recognize in therapy counseling, that because of a sense of depression, because of a sense of alienation, often due to just simply transition, it made them liable to accept simplistic answers. It's much easier to see your parents at fault than to see the world at fault, or you at fault, or just the human condition at fault. Freud's dictum for treatment is to replace neurotic anxiety with everyday discontent. Unfortunately, we live in a society where we're not supposed to have everyday discontent, and it's very easy, therefore, for certain cult-like therapists to feed upon this and to expand it. And in the same way, siblings have to recognize that just as they were not perfect, their siblings were not perfect, and that again, by focusing on the future, they have a life ahead of them, as opposed to looking at the past, and they have a life of remonstration behind them. And I think if people can begin to develop this forward, I don't know if the word is optimistic, but positive orientation, I think that much that has been unpleasant can be worked through. Thank you.
Next, from this sort of overarching view of the influence of the past and the need to look to the future, we have Susan Robbins, who's going to talk about a very practical way to deal with some of the issues in the family. Susan is the Associate Dean for Academic Affairs and Associate Professor at the Graduate School of Social Work, University of Houston. Dr. Robbins.
Thank you. Even though I was trained psychoanalytically, I am not now, nor have I ever been a psychoanalyst. I disavow that and always have. I am very fortunate in that I'm going to be talking about mediation, family mediation today. However, I want you to know that I come to this in helping families in a variety of different capacities. In addition to being a mediator for close to 20 years, and doing a variety of different kinds of mediation before I got into this kind of mediation, I'm also a therapist, but before you boo and hiss, not one of the bad ones. And I'm also an educator, and I'm also a trainer. And in that regard, Laura, I have something very directly to say to you. Well, no. You talked about the evils of Child Protective Services, CPS. I am very fortunate as an educator and trainer. I am now doing training for the entire state of Texas and every region for CPS on false accusations made by children. And even better than that, thank you. I cannot tell you what it took to get that workshop through. Usually my workshops fly through like that. I've been doing drug abuse training for them for 5-6 years. When I proposed the false allegations, it took multiple conferences with state office, state legal, and you name it. But it went through, and it was so well received last year that one of the attorneys for CPS happened to be in my training in Houston, and she said, Susan, we want you to do this for all of the lawyers in Texas. You want to talk about making significant change? We did our first workshop on false allegations. In fact, I might look tired because I flew to Lubbock, Texas, where they grow nothing but dirt and weeds. Nothing against Lubbock. And came back home just in time to repack to come here. Where we're doing training for CPS attorneys who are getting this message loud and clear, prosecutors, district attorney's office, and some judges are actually showing up to these trainings. So if there's any change that's going to be made in children's false allegations, and there is an overlap, by the way, as some of you know, between children's false allegations and recovered memories. The first case that was ever referred to me was a recovered memory case in which the accusing, and I'm going to use the word offspring, I hate the word adult child, because it infantilizes grown-ups, in which the client who enlisted my services was not only accused by her offspring, but also made an accusation that her daughter was being molested. So there is an overlap in that. So the good news is that at least in Texas, we're going to make some progress, and the lawyers are talking about making legislative changes. And that's where the difference is going to be seen. Okay, on to mediation. Many people come to me wanting me to help them in some way, and some of them come asking for mediation. Now, what I want to tell you is that when you enlist a mediator to help you with something like this, the mediator is not your advocate. If you come to that mediator to be your advocate, that person is not a mediator. The role of the mediator is a neutral third party. Now, it always helps. In fact, it's to your advantage to have somebody who knows something about this, rather than somebody who knows nothing about it. Because all too often, I see mediators falling into wanting to help one party or the other. Having been a mediator for close to 20 years, I can tell you when I'm doing other kinds of mediations, you sit there and you listen to both parties, and you always personally take sides with one or the other. I've sat there in mediations and said under my breath to myself, that lying so-and-so, I can see right through that. And boy, this person has a good case. But what do I say professionally? As I bring myself in the neutral role of the mediator to the mediation table, I say, would you please so help the other person understand your position? Well, if I find inconsistencies, I don't blame it on them. I say, I'm having trouble taking notes. There's something I'm not understanding. So I'm putting responsibility on me. Help me understand. Before you said X and now you're saying Y. I must have missed something. Would you please help me understand that? The role of the mediator is not only to be neutral, but to get in a position where both parties, or all parties, can save face. And what I found in mediations with false accusations, it is very important to let the accuser save face. It's also very important to let the parents save face, because sometimes they say things that they then bite their tongue and they think they shouldn't have said. So if you're expecting somebody to be your very strong advocate at the mediation table, that if the person does that, that person is not doing mediation. They're doing advocacy, and what that's going to do is scare the accuser off. On the other hand, there is a place in mediation to be advocates for both parties. Now, what am I advocating for both parties? To increase communication between them. That's the outcome that I want to see. I want to see them able to talk to each other in not necessarily non-emotional terms, because emotions, when you've got conflict, folks, think back to the last time you were in conflict about anything. Separate from this, are there emotions associated with conflict? Absolutely. A whole range of emotions. So it's not that you don't want them to be emotional, but to express it in a way that the other person can hear what is going on. The role of the mediator is to be able to help people rephrase so that all parties can hear what the other person is saying. Sometimes when things get heated in mediation, one party starts screaming and yelling or crying. And it's the role of the mediator then to say to the person, if they're crying especially, do we need to take a break? Or would you like to take a break? Or if somebody's yelling and screaming, again, I'll put the responsibility on myself and say, I'm unable to hear you when you're yelling that loudly. Can I ask, well, obviously I know what it's doing to the other party, right? But I put it on myself and say, I'm unable to hear you when you're yelling that loudly, and I think that so-and-so is having problems too. I must ask you to please lower your voice and speak a little bit slower so I can take careful notes. Now, the role of advocacy, mediation is really joint advocacy. Co-joint advocacy. In other words, I'm advocating for both parties, as strange as that might sound. Separate from who I believe or know is guilty or innocent in any kind of mediation, I want party A to have their side entirely told. I want them to be able to express whatever they want to express. I want party B to be able to have their story told and to express whatever they want to express. And I need to create a very safe forum for that to happen. Now, I cannot create a safe forum if I am taking sides with one party or the other. Again, my personal self as opposed to professional self. Do you understand that distinction? Inside my head, I could be saying, you lying so-and-so. And on the table, I'm saying, please help so-and-so understand that. There are several different kinds of mediation. I'm keep this brief because I'm also doing a roundtable on mediation. One form of mediation is called caucus style. Don't get worried about the words. What that means is the mediator meets with one party separately, then and meets with the other party separately. And that way people are never faced, put in a room face to face with each other. Sometimes, particularly in false memory allegations, that is the only kind of mediation that you get to do. Why? Because the accusing offspring refuses to meet. But they might be willing to talk to me, and there are limited kinds of things that I can do, but I can certainly talk to them about what is it that you are willing to do, if anything. And I can brainstorm with them and say, well, what if X, Y, and Z happens? Would you be willing to have contact with your parents in that case? And I could talk to the other party on the phone and say, well, what your offspring has told me, in this case usually daughters, is X, Y, and Z. Would you be willing, again, I'm not making decisions for them, that's not the role of the mediator. If the mediator tells you what to do, or tells anybody what to do, and insists on it, the person is not doing mediation. And I can bring positions back and forth in a caucus-style mediation. The majority of mediations that I've done, by the way, are caucus-style, most of them over the phone, just simply because it's very, very hard to get accusing offspring who are not yet ready to see their parents face-to-face in a room face-to-face. The other style of mediation, and the one that I think is the most effective, is the non-caucus mediation, or the one where you get everybody around a table talking to each other. Now, both styles can work. They both have their liabilities, and they both have their strengths. But again, if you are going to a mediator expecting that person to be an advocate for you, and that person agrees to be an advocate for you 100%, that person is not doing mediation. The person is doing advocacy, and it's going to put your accusing offspring off. So be careful if you're going for mediation and choosing mediators. Make sure that you have somebody who's competent and qualified. And I would also say somebody who knows something about this. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Dr. Robbins. I'm curious, how many people in the audience, how many families have used mediation? We show of hands for the scattering. How many of you would contemplate using mediation? Many more. Well, we have, that's a whole approach that is obviously underutilized. So thank you, Dr. Robbins, for bringing this to our attention. Now, the next person on the panel, just in order of our seating arrangement here, is Dr. Collin, who's a professor of psychology at Rutgers and a nationally known authority on hypnosis, and has written a number of books and many articles about hypnosis, and through his work with hypnosis became a very close friend of Dr. Orne, and they worked together on a number of projects. Dr. Halperin, my pleasure to... Dr. Collin.
Thank you, Al. I appreciate the introduction. I wanted to talk today kind of in a good news, bad news framework, because I think there's good news and I think there's bad news out there. I think there's good news and I think there's bad news out there. And I don't want to underline either, because I think that they're both very important things. First of all, let me just relate some personal experiences. I'm also a mediator. I've been trained in mediation. I do a fair amount of it. And it really is something that, as a resource, is vastly underutilized in this kind of situation. It is possible for mediators to help people talk to each other through them, in the same room as them, to recreate an atmosphere of civility, of mutual tolerance, if not respect, that makes it possible for even the nastiest, miserablest conflicts to at least take a little bit of the edge, have a little bit of the edge taken off, and it makes it possible for people to talk with each other eventually. So if you're family is one in which your child has not returned, is totally alienated, think about mediation, think about contact through a mediator, think about the kind of thing that you just heard about. It can be a very powerful tool. You know, the second thing I want to say, the title of our meeting this time is Return to Reason. And Dr. Halpern note that the tendrils of reason were reaching out over the wounds. There really is out there an enormous amount of stopping the craziness that happens more and more. Just like in Texas and New Jersey, which just a few years ago passed one of those horrible laws that there is no statute of limitations for repressed memory and the return of repressed memory, etc. And a year later, we had it at the Institute for Continuing Legal Education, which is a joint project of Rutgers and the New Jersey Bar Association. We had two things. We had a meeting on this kind of issue in which the basic thing that was discussed was not the incest or whatever, it was false allegations. It was the whole question of, can we believe these things? What happens when we get people coming in and saying these things? Do we understand that these kinds of things are not true a reasonable amount of the time? And for lawyers to be discussing that at their meeting. And then as a result in part of that meeting, a year later Steve Cici came and gave a workshop on childhood memory and on the kind of thing that Beth Loftus and he and others have been doing for years in terms of bringing to the lawyers of New Jersey. And the room was packed. It was a room about twice, three times the size of this one. And that room was packed. And people sat there for 48 hours and then wanted more. So, I mean, it was really an amazing change. DIFAS, our Child Protective Services organization, we have the same nonsense as everybody else has, and you know, and it's and the contagion from one DIFAS worker to another, because all too often there are six people who are involved in a case. The turnover in DIFAS workers in our state being just extreme with you, yeah. There are a certain number of families who say, wait a minute, guys, this didn't happen. And up until now, the procedure has been, okay, we'll keep your kids away, and it'll be 6 months or a year or 15 months or 2 years from now. And if anything, some of the legalities, here's some bad news, have gotten worse in this circumstances, because the federal government has just passed the Child Protective Safety Act. I've forgotten the formal name of that thing. But it used to say family reunification was at least as high a priority as the safety of the child. And now only the safety of the child can be considered. And the termination of parental rights has been speeded up enormously. That means they take your child away. Sorry, Charlie, that's it. This is not pleasant stuff. But the other side of that is the courts are often not crazy. The courts are often manned by and women by sane people who are concerned about injustice and concerned about these questions. In New Jersey now, we've just started, Greg Firestone, you may know, came and did some training workshop, and I now, among others, not just attorneys. I guess I'm one of two non-attorneys on the panel. We're now mediating. We're having meetings right towards the beginning of this process by family who are contesting our Department of Youth and Family Services accusations. We have meetings that include the law guardian for the child, the DIFAS people, their attorney, who's the Deputy Attorney General for the state, who works with DIFAS, and the parents and their attorneys, court appointed if necessary, and people from the community, such as a minister or a rabbi or whoever's, and grandparents. And we're bringing these people all together in one room and asking that reason prevail, and that some sort of ability to talk to each other, to come to reasonable evaluations, to bring some sort of sanity out of the insanity that often goes on in this situation, so that the resolution that occurs quickly is not necessarily termination of parental rights, but can be the bringing of the child back into a family in a situation in which everybody knows the child is safe. And there are circumstances in which you don't want that to happen, in which you don't want a child returned to a family, and there are circumstances in which you can create situations which are safe for a child to be returned to a family. So we've got good news and bad news out there. Now, there's a reason why there's good news, all right? We had a social movement in this country 15, 12, 11, 10 years ago when this organization started that I thought was unstoppable, that terrified me, because we have in this room some of the casualties of that social movement. We had an insanity about the role of fathers, the role of parents in incest and in with very young children, things we knew just didn't happen practically at all, were all of a sudden epidemic. At the same time, we had multiple personalities arising right, left, and center, satanic ritual abuse. We had a plague in psychotherapy. Psychotherapy has basically, over the years, been a fairly benign event in people's lives. The one time that it's not is when it takes somebody outside the psychotherapy dyad, usually, up until recently, it was usually the mother who got blamed, and blames that person who's outside the therapy dyad for the problem of the person who's inside the therapy dyad. And we've seen this again and again. We had schizophrenic mothers. We had mothers who were responsible for homosexuality in men. We had the parents of autistic children. I had a mildly autistic child myself 20 years ago. I would have been told that it was my coldness and rottenness and no goodness that caused my child to be like this. We have seen this again and again. This is not news, all right? And it is the plague of psychotherapy, and we have to deal with it. I don't know how we're going to deal with it, except the way this organization has. I mean, there are people in this room who have stopped this plague, okay? Pam and Peter, Alan and Toby, Fred Cruz, Martin, who's no longer with us, Martin Orne and Emily Orne. We have, I mean, there's just an incredible bunch of people in this room. I could, you know, keep naming names. Paul McHugh, Robin Dawes, Beth Loftus, Charles Cavanis, Casonis. I mean, there are people in this room who have essentially managed to stop this plague in its tracks. It doesn't mean it's over. But it damn well would have been so much worse if it had not been for this organization, and not just the leaders, but the people who let them say what had to be said. I want to talk just a little bit about hypnosis, about psychotherapy, and again, the good news and the bad news. You know, these are tools, guys. These are tools that can be misused, and in the hands of the ignorant and the arrogant, and too many of my colleagues are among them, they can be horribly devastating tools, but they can also be tools for healing. There are therapies out there which, if you or a child, an adult child, I'm sorry, I'm still use that terminology, can use some help. There's cognitive behavior therapy. There's interpersonal therapy. There are therapies out there which do not go back into the depths of the past and believe you have to overcome the trauma of the times. Those therapies in the right hands, the depth therapies, can be very useful. There's no doubt that in the hands of some of the people up here that those therapies can be very useful. They can also, as Dr. Cruz has pointed out, be very, very, very tricky to handle. But there are therapies out there that won't hurt you in the same way. Cognitive BT, IPT, these are therapies that have stood the test of carefully controlled, placebo-controlled studies. They do have efficacy. They help. They constantly ask the question, what is the evidence for beliefs? What does that belief say to you? Why are you holding it? What does it mean to you to have the belief? Again, what is the evidence? What is the evidence? What is the evidence? But one of Beth Loftus's editorials, which she was president of APS, American Psychological Society, a couple, 3 years ago, I guess it was 2 years ago, Beth, was, you know, was essentially an address to some students in a commencement in England. And she kept saying, what is the evidence? What is the evidence? And again, what is the evidence? Well, there are therapies that ask that question. CBT asks of people all the time, cognitive behavior therapy, a school, you know, which came out of psychoanalysis, actually. I as an old behaviorist, hate to say that, but it's true. Tim Beck started off as a psychoanalyst. And there are schools of psychotherapy which really try to ask that question. Don't throw away the baby with the bathwater, because in this particular case, it is often necessary for a returnee or recanter to have the aid of a psychotherapy relationship that can be positive. And there are those therapy relationships out there. I also want to finally just say one thing. I don't think there's any possible grief for a parent like the loss of a child. I can't think of anything that can match that particular grief. To have a child alive who won't talk to you is to have one's heart torn into a million pieces. I don't know how to tell you how much we, the professionals, have been involved in this organization, celebrate the courage, the bravery, and the capacity to share and heal each other that the parents in this organization have had to go through over the years and have had to endure and have had to live through. I can't tell anybody whether to accept the child back who will not admit the falsity of a false accusation. I don't think any of us can tell each other that. But I do know that any way that parents and children can be brought together to talk to each other, at least, is better than nothing for most parents. And to, you know, no matter what heartache it is to come together, it's the bad news that it's the heartache, but it's the good news that people are returning. And, you know, I mean, the professionals are not going to change this. They're going to at most offer some help in this. Chris Barden scared so many people with his Marvel's lawsuits that the professionals have stopped doing what they were doing and the numbers they were doing it. There has been an enormous change in the atmosphere out there. If this is the last meeting of this organization, know very much that all of us who have worked as professionals in this area over the last few years honor you with very, very, very deep feeling for what you have gone through and what you continue to go through. And we would help and will help if we can.
Well said, Bob. Harold Mirsky is our next speaker. Harold is a psychiatrist at the University of Western Ontario, professor in the Department of Psychiatry. He's an expert in the area of pain. He's been on our scientific and professional advisory board since its inception. Harold is one of his areas of interest more recently has been the impact of recovered memory therapy on the mental and emotional state of the patients undergoing this form of abuse, therapeutic abuse. And of course, he's found that the patients are far worse as a consequence of therapy than they were when they entered therapy. Am I quoting? Is that correct summation, Harold?
Yes. Yes, indeed. Harold, thank you. I suppose we all have to make a confession, so mine is that I was trained by a psychoanalyst. Worse, he was trained by Freud. But I'm not a psychoanalyst, and in fact I still have a great regard for the doctor, Erwin Stengel, who trained me. but I don't think he would have, I don't think he even did go along with all Freudian theory. I'd like to make one point only about Freud, and that is that I don't think it was real abuse that he discovered. I don't think it was his patient's fantasy. I think it was his own fantasy. And I used to be proud of the, as it were, ancestral descent within psychiatry that I could boast about, but it's a little different now. I want to be very pragmatic. Time requires that anyhow, and but finish with a flight or two, not so much of fantasy as fancy. We heard the retractors today, and it was extremely interesting. I think I took away from what they said the idea, in particular, in response to Pam Fry's question, where she scooped me and asked the question I wanted to ask, that there were two times and ways in which retraction might start. One was if there was a break in treatment, and the other was when the story's got to be really too fantastic. I encountered a third way in which things might start to recover, and that was when the stories were not so much fantastic, though they were a bit in the direction of satanic ritual abuse, as bringing the patient to feel that she was going to be isolated from everybody else who might be with her, because first of all the therapists had taken her away from her parents and the other siblings, and then they were beginning to undermine her relationship with her husband, and she thought, well, really, now this is too much. And she did step back and begin the process of recovery. If we draw some conclusions from those three elements, or three ways in which a recovery might start, then we can have some practical ideas. They might apply to one or two people. If you get the chance, offer the patient a holiday. If you get the chance, possible. It's often, you don't expect that you'll immediately get agreement, but the mere fact of saying things from time to time is valuable in psychotherapy. Many times I have patients with depression, and all psychiatrists who treat with any sensitivity will have this experience, patients with depression to whom one will say, you're going to feel better. I know that. I know you don't feel well now, and I think I know it's hard for you to believe that things are going to help, and that you can become, that you can recover. But there is a really good chance of recovery. And one can say that with depression because it's true, and you shouldn't say it if it isn't true. And the patient finds it hard to believe that because the depression itself takes away hope. But later on, after recovery, patients will regularly confirm that this sort of talk is valuable to them and does make a difference. And I think one should say the things and send the cards and maintain the attitudes to potential retractors in the same way as one maintains this attitude to depression in supporting patients who are in treatment. Of course, don't agree that you did anything wrong if you didn't. Nothing is worse or more harmful than the plea bargain, whether it's an implicit plea bargain without a legal consequence or an actual plea bargain by an innocent person. Continue the offer of love. Help the patient to take a break and highlight the impossible, as I've said. And don't make your own situation worse by dwelling on guilt and excess feelings of failure in bringing up children. Everybody fails somewhere in bringing up children. Difficulties with children and between parents have been known for generations. It's forever. It's part of psychiatry, it's part of life. You can have some faith that reasonable psychiatry will assist the patient and yourselves. Psychotherapy, there are some bad psychotherapies, and then there are a number of good forms of psychotherapy. as Robert Carlin has been saying, which can be practiced badly or can be practiced well. So the trick is to first of all rule out the bad psychotherapies, and then if you can seek to find or insert or insinuate somebody who's a good psychotherapist. The experience of dissent in the family, of false accusations, of actual sexual abuse, all these experiences are old and long storied. Sibling rivalry goes back to Joseph being sold as a slave by his brothers. False accusations, Ralph Underwager pointed out, and Holly Wakefield in their book, false accusations also go back to Joseph with the wife of Potiphar. These are old and enduring human problems, unfortunately. We need to do all we can to deal with them currently and in modern forms, but they're nothing new. In a sense, what we've got here is old vinegar in new bottles. What can you expect from good psychological or psychiatric practice? There is an aphorism in medicine that the aim of the physician is to, or the hope of the physician should be to cure sometimes, to relieve often, and to comfort always. I think you should expect that from anybody who attempts to assist you or your family in processes of recovery. Those are the perspectives that I would like to offer, and join the rest in sitting down.
I think the message you've heard from several members of the panel is that there is good psychotherapy, and the trick is to have enough trust that there is and find the appropriate person with the appropriate form of therapy, but don't throw out all of psychotherapy as being horrible. I can understand why many people in this audience have that particular point of view, but please reconsider.